Movies are little bits of captured time, performances and moments imprinted on celluloid or in digital bits. Film is a form of illusion, and one of its most lasting illusions is that it preserves for the ages those who make movies. I'm Charles Horak, and you're listening to On Film. The work of our favorite filmmakers may seem eternal, but the flesh and blood artists who make the movies aren't immune to the forward march of time. Today we look back at the year 2014 and the passing parade of cinema greats who are no longer with us. To help in our remembrance, I'm happy to have back on the program Jay Duncan, film historian and director of the Sunset Film Society. Good morning, Jay.
Good morning, Chuck. Thank you for having me.
We used to do this every year, but I think we broke for a year or two.
I think we started like in 2005, and I think it's been since 2012 since we've done this.
Yeah, well, I know it's a topic near and dear to our hearts. It is quite bittersweet to think of the passing of the folks we're going to talk about today, but it always brings back a lot of fond memories for me because you can't say the names we're about to name without seeing in your mind all of these great films.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It is indeed a snapshot, I think, of their careers rushing past as we remember them.
So we'll call this a celebration instead.
Absolutely.
Well, 2014 was another one of those years that saw the passing of many important filmmakers from really every age of the cinema. We still are going all the way back to the silent period with a few of these. Mm-hmm. What's a notable personality you want to highlight from last year?
You know, Maximilian Schell may not be on the lips of everyone, but they would certainly be aware of his work, I think, if nothing more than Judgment at Nuremberg, for instance, which he won Best Actor for in 1961.
Big film.
And it was only his second Hollywood film. And Stanley Kramer production. But, you know, you may remember The Young Lions, and it had such people as Marlon Brando and Montgomery Clift, Top Cappy, a classic.
Jules Dassin, crime caper.
Fun stuff. The Odessa File, Julia, even into Disney territory with The Black Hole, which was some people were rather unkind with, said it was kind of like Captain Nemo in outer space. But it had those same elements, you know, of kind of an authoritative figure and other people either searching for something or trying to escape from something.
He had a certain stature.
He did. And, you know, a lot of people may not realize he had a very noteworthy sister named Maria Schell. You may remember in The Hanging Tree with Gary Cooper, the brothers Karamazov, or Cimarron with Glenn Ford. She was his elder by, I think, 3 or 4 years, and she passed away some time back.
Ubiquitous for a number of decades. I think he worked just about every year from Nuremberg on.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Someone I wanted to spotlight is from behind the camera, and a lot of the folks we're going to talk about today are perhaps household names, but this may not be. Gordon Willis. He was a famed cinematographer and quickly earned the nickname the Prince of Darkness.
Yes, and just by looking over some of his films, you can see how that would fit apropos.
No relation to the man, but he had a real gift for illuminating in the darkness scenes. If people think of the Godfather trilogy, you know, the murkiness of many of those scenes and the technical difficulty, really, of shooting in such low light. He mastered that early on in his career and was sought out for that. But it wasn't murkiness or darkness for its own sake. He brought that to a number of films where it really fit the thematic tone.
It did. I think it worked, created an atmosphere that was very suitable for the subject matter that was being presented on screen.
People will also remember his work in All the President's Men. This is one where that contrast went back and forth between extremely brightly lit scenes, usually in the Washington Post. Leonard Bernstein are pursuing the truth, and he brings this this well-lit, almost harsh light to all of that they're doing. And then when they go to the halls of power, of political power, it becomes murky again, and it's like you're in a cavern lit with a candle.
Or meet Deep Throat in the parking garage, you know, where it's basically lit by a cigarette.
In that film, I think, too, you can see him using these two young reporters and often showing them dwarfed by their political surroundings, their tiny figures. And so he was just a man of incredible artistry that was also known for a number of Woody Allen films in perhaps Woody Allen's most golden age. and people will remember, hopefully, his work in Manhattan, the beautiful black and white cinematography. I'm not sure anybody shot New York better than Gordon Willis.
Right. It's gorgeous. And only Woody Allen could probably get away with doing a black and white movie that late.
That's right.
You know.
That's right.
Which was fabulous for us as audience members. You know, I mean, one of the three from the golden age of Hollywood that we lost in 2014 was certainly Mickey Rooney.
Oh, sure.
Diminutive in height at 5'2".
7 feet tall in personality.
Absolutely. A giant in talent. I think there's nothing that he couldn't do. I mean, if the role required, which it did in many cases, to play the drums, he was professional. He could do comedy. He could do drama. He was literally born in a trunk, and I think later in some interviews with him, he mentioned that he basically had been working 99 decades since he was about 17 months old, and he was a member of his mom and dad's vaudeville show. They made a special tuxedo for him, you know, rubber cigar, the whole nine yards, and there's not many people that have lasted that long that have been in upward of 300 film appearances who survived the silent era, radio, television, vaudeville, motion pictures, and was still working pretty much with the final, I guess, appearance in this third or fourth Night at the Museum. And very difficult by most people's standards,
right,
because he was – what you saw is what he got, what you got. He was loud, boisterous, but – you couldn't fault his talent, and he had it to back him up, I think. And so a lot of people just went with the ride.
I wanted to mention, too, that, you know, from that same period, Shirley Temple we lost last year, too, who obviously was a huge child star that, unlike Rooney, went away from show business and did a number of other great things with her life.
Ambassador to, was it Ghana and to Czechoslovakia, I think, at some points in her life. And was the number one box office star from 1935 to 1938, which is no mean task right there.
Segwaying right into Mickey Rooney's career.
That's true.
I was looking over some of the lists we've seen for last year, and one of the ones that popped out for me was Alain Resnais, the French film director who was part of that movement of what became known as the French New Wave.
Yes.
These young Turks that came up in the late 50s, early 60s, making films that really challenged the very staid way of making French films. And frankly, took that rejuvenation around the world. There were a lot of new waves that were sparked around that time in Japan and Czechoslovakia and a number of other countries. But people may remember his films, the 1959 film Hiroshima Mon Amour, Je T'aime, Je T'aime from 68, of course, Last Year at Marienbad from 1961. He began making short documentaries, though, in the 50s, and one of the most powerful ones that was Night and Fog about the Holocaust.
Oh, yes.
And,
powerful. Powerful.
Still one of the great documentaries, I think, about the Holocaust, and that was from 1955. So I wanted to mention his name.
And he was 91, I guess, at his passing. So he had a
And
had
it continued
career.
To work.
Absolutely.
And he made a film almost every year.
That's true. So. Moving on, I guess, in a little bit of change of pace, H.R. Giger. Not maybe a name that comes to people's minds with an image of the man, but if anyone who hasn't seen Alien, first of all, the whole conceptual look of that film, that organic kind of biomechanical look of the space jockey, the huge craft that's found on the planet, the alien itself, was from this man's mind.
It was like nothing we had seen on screen before.
Nothing. Absolutely nothing. In 1979, when this film came out, I think we were all blown away by not only the concept and the look, but this dark kind of a gothic haunted house movie aboard a spaceship with each member meeting its demise, you know, in some terrible way. And he was a Swiss surrealist painter, a sculptor and a set designer, and he studied architecture and industrial design. And he was part of the special effects team that won the Academy Award that year for Alien. He did poster art for Future Kill. He worked with recording artists and designed record album covers for Deborah Harry, Emerson Lake and Palmer, and on and on. So that's another man, and he was only 74.
Yeah, a unique perspective on art that is unlike anything you've ever seen. I wanted to say a brief word about two people we lost last year to suicide. Yes. Unfortunately, this happens far too often, but these were both incredible persons. Robin Williams, of course, the comedian, television star, then film star, then there's almost nothing he couldn't do, and it always brought this infectious, just manicness to many of his characters, but also played some very dark characters along the way, like in Insomnia. Mm-hmm. But I think people will remember him for his work in Aladdin and Happy Feet, the animated films. I remember first seeing him in The World According to Garp, one of his very earliest films.
Yes.
Just after Popeye, which is
right.
I think was his first film, but it was probably a misguided to ever bring Popeye to the big screen. But, you know, Dead Poets Society, Good Will Hunting, Flubber, Mrs. Doubtfire, The Fisher King is one of my favorite films.
Which, and I Awakenings.
Awakenings,
you know,
which
another one
a lot of people may not have seen.
With Robert De Niro and Robin Williams playing it straight. Very, very effective.
And as his career went on, I think people realized that underneath all that manic happiness and impersonations and comic relief, if you will, there was a man of great substance, and he often got to play those roles later in life, and we lost him. But we also lost Philip Seymour Hoffman to drug addiction, possible suicide. But people remember his portrayals of Truman Capote, his work in Doubt, Charlie Wilson's War, which he won a Best Supporting Actor, The Master, the incredible P.T. Anderson film.
Absolutely.
Early film of his, Boogie Nights, is
I think
the first time I really paid attention to him
and
in a small role.
Member of the troupe in Twister, before we even knew who he was, really, you know?
Always distinguished himself in everything he did.
Yes, 46 years old. Eli Wallach was probably one of the oldest that we lost this year, or in 2014, at age 98. His alma mater was UT Austin. Through the years, I'd heard rumblings of, and I know it's true, that he had a sister living in El Paso, who I believe was a school teacher. And so he was no stranger to this area, you know, through the years. Mm. You know, he had a six-decade spanning career, and he did everything from over 90 film credits. His debut was in Baby Doll for Elia Kazan. Tried out for the role of Maggio, in which ultimately went to Frank Sinatra and From Here to Eternity, but he turned it down in order to work with Kazan in a Tennessee Williams play called Camino Real.
In that age group, I'd have to wrap up with Lauren Bacall, one of the greatest of the classic period. Of course, getting her big break at the age of 19 in Howard Hawks' To Have and Have Not, where she would meet the love of her life, Humphrey Bogart, and was a tough woman that found many ways to rejuvenate her career over the years. Well, thank you, Jay, for coming in and helping us honor this group who've had a tremendous influence on cinema and future filmmakers.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
I've been discussing the lives and art of some of the cinema's important filmmakers who passed away in 2014 with film historian Jay Duncan. For an expanded list of movie icons and great artists we lost in 2014, log on to onfilmsarchive@ktep.org or email this station. Jay Duncan is director of the Sunset Film Society, which screens an assortment of movie classics at Artavino's Desert Crossing. And you can get more information and a calendar of upcoming screenings at sunsetfilmsociety.org. On Film's producer is Norma Martinez. An archive of past programs is available on this station's website at ktep.org. I'm Charles Horak. Thank you for listening to On Film.